From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Liftoff, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. I'm Ellen Burns Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy, I too make nice games.
So once an idea for a game has been greenlit, what comes next? In this episode, we talk with Rick Stem, design manager and narrative director at Pikpok, to discuss how things get going. And if so, everyone's ready, let's start.
You almost got it.
So close.
Almost nailed it.
You know, I got the timing right, but I definitely missed the words. I've only done it like how many?
10 out of 10 for the things that matter. Because you were saying just before we started that you're from Wisconsin, you lived in Texas for years, and you are now based in New Zealand.
Yes.
And so let's hint a little bit. Maybe you can talk more about that as we get into it, but hint a little bit about what's that like.
Yeah, definitely. And again, I don't know. At some point, we'll probably want to give some context for Pikpok. You know, we're New Zealand's largest game studio, and we mostly make mobile games. So, sorry, you wanted to talk about the transition from the Midwest to Texas to New Zealand.
Yeah, let's touch on that quick before we get into the proper topic.
That's a lot of miles.
I'm very curious.
Yeah. So when I was in Wisconsin, I wasn't really in the game scene. I was an instructional designer, which is where I learned so much about design, building teams, pitching ideas, quick first drafts, iterations, all audience-based, you know, narratives and design. That was great. Though there was a bit of a budding game design scene. Educational games are pretty big in Wisconsin. The university does some cool stuff. And my pal Dan is one of the co-founders of Filament Games, educational games company in Wisconsin. So I was more involved in education and theater. That's also where I cut my teeth as a playwright. And develop the artistic side. And then in Texas, I did educational games for a little bit until the companies went under. And then, you know, lacking a game scene, had a similar journey to you guys, where there were a bunch of us who were like, hey, we're game devs. I thought I was the only game dev here. Let's get together. And so we formed a chapter of the IGDA. We had some meetups where we would just, you know, play each other's games or... my friends work in the Cleveland Game Devs Meetup, which is the biggest indie meetup, and we got some ideas from them about how to do some things. So yeah, we would have like monthly gatherings, social gatherings, and you know, playtest sessions and stuff like that. And then one of the big wins that has now gone away is I managed to hook up with Robert Koo when PAX South came to San Antonio, and he was super cool. And he gave us a slot every year to speak and have a local game dev meetup at PAX South, where we would talk and organize people, and he would give us a bunch of free passes for students. And so that really helped kind of get us going. I think the city didn't get behind PAX as much as it should have, but the local community did. And then I backpacked in New Zealand 20 years ago because I'm a Lord of the Rings nerd. And I was like, where in the world could be Middle Earth? And started researching this country. And yeah, I f***ed off there for 3 months, which is what you could do at the time with the U.S. passport. Fell in love with it and promised myself I'd get back. And then my lives came together that way. I got to New Zealand through a game design job at Pikpok. So going from, you know, education to educational games to indie games to, you know, full games industry through New Zealand. And I started as a game designer, but I originated the game design manager role. So just as I started, the design department was growing enough that we needed managers. We were the only department that didn't have managers because we had been kind of small and new. Pikpok started mostly with programmers and artists making little mobile games. So, you know, game design was kind of a new thing. So I was alongside my colleague, Shaunak, who works for Niantic now. We were the first game design managers. And then as our storytelling arm grew as well, through the work of my excellent narrative designer, Mike, and my own advocacy and work, we finally got the green light to found a narrative team. So now I have four narrative designers working with me and doing our games, which is probably my proudest accomplishment, is actually getting storytelling going as a formal department at Pikpok.
That's awesome.
Nice, nice.
Cool.
Yeah, that's a lot of miles and a lot of interesting disciplines too, kind of wrapped up into that story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's important when you think about games too. Games are unique, right? And you always need to think about the player, the audience, the mechanics, the interactions. And that's what games are great at and unique for. But yeah, theater backgrounds, art backgrounds, education backgrounds, film backgrounds, role playing backgrounds, all that stuff counts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's also telling that, as you were describing, founding departments and like, game companies can get by without a lot of stuff. Which is so scary, right? Because you're like, why don't we have... It's like, well, we only have so many resources. We only have so many people. Yep. We only have so much work to do. And sometimes when you're starting out certain companies, the things you make don't require as much effort in some departments.
Yeah.
You don't... You just have people pitch in. And it's interesting how so many companies need to relearn the lesson. There's no like template to get going. And there's no final form either. right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, especially true of narrative, because while we occasionally make premium story-driven games, a lot of free-to-play mobile games don't have traditional narrative.
Yeah.
And so the narrative design comes more in the environmental storytelling, in the theming of the game, which explains the mechanics, in, you know, kind of how we place the UI and that kind of stuff. So, you know, you don't actually do a lot of writing, but more just kind of holistic experiential design.
Yeah. Which is its own level of challenge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was a big part of our department, is I whipped together this kind of silly narrative test that was like 7 different crazy challenges of being like, not just can you write stories, but can you write notifications? Can you write, you know, 3-word lines of dialogue?
Oh, yeah.
Can you describe a scene, you know, purely in the props in the scene? Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's so interesting. Like, as someone who tends to put my finger in every pie available to me, I'm a big believer in using one discipline to do the work of another discipline, because it's like all holistic, it's all the same in the end. And formalizing that is really fascinating, because like finding a way to do that and do it deliberately and not just sort of as it happens, which is how I generally do it. that's a really interesting sort of cross-disciplinary discipline.
That's it really is.
Insightful to me.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, we're still learning. We're still figuring it out, you know, how we work in. There's a lot of teams who still kind of think narrative design is just game writing. And they're like, oh, we'll call you when we need words on it. And we're like, no. We can help you, like, figure out how your mechanical decisions and your art and stuff tell the story. We can do it without words.
Yeah. And you should, right? Because, I mean, the player is getting it all at once. It's all just one experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of goes back to what you were saying, Mark. That everything becomes everything else. It's all the same thing.
Yeah.
Do without words is a good summary of it too.
I like that too.
Yeah.
Our art director uses the word cohesive a lot, and I think that's a good way to get at what you're describing.
Yeah. Yep. And that works for other disciplines too. Is kind of, I guess, the sort of point I'm circling around, which is like, you know, sometimes you actually want to pull back on the art and you want to have a character describe it in audio or text because that's more powerful to the story or to the experience. But I think that's another thing. I mean, it's not just for, I think narrative is probably the, maybe the least respected discipline in terms of this, but I think it applies elsewhere as well, right? Sometimes you need a simpler system or a less complicated bit of code to do something, and that's the right choice because of something you're trying to do, the demands of another discipline.
Yeah.
Right? That can handle it better. What the feel.
Absolutely.
Anyway, I'm going way off now because
we're talking about
game design is like such a hobby horse of mine. But I think like, let's get started with the proper topic here, because I think you're an interesting person to focus on this because of the background you've just described. Mm-hmm. But this sort of like, okay, everyone said yes, now what? Right? That's where we start from this.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just start there. Like, now what? Like, what's the first step?
Yeah. So interestingly, that I will say that depends. And I'll explain that a little bit, because that's a shitty answer by itself. So when you're a large-ish, you know, we're 200 people, which is large for New Zealand, but not large for, you know, we're not AAA. But when you have a company, we've been around 25 years, there's a lot of, you know, we think hard before we greenlight a game. And so there's usually some combination. I'm paraphrasing my CEO here, Mario Winans, who's been great for the games industry here. But we usually look for some combination of course, is it fun? You know, is there a core idea that's fun? Do we have the resources to make it? Meaning, like, do we have the staff available, but also, do we have, you know, the technical expertise? Have we made similar games? You know, things like that. Is there a market opportunity, right? Are we not competing with AAA people in this space? Is it something we know well, or, you know, there's an open market? And, you know, does it fit into the timeline? You know, can we release it based on the other games we're releasing? So there's like all of those factors get considered when we greenlight a game. And so, but often one of those factors might be more to the forefront. So if the thing is like, you know, a market opportunity, then what next is usually user research, market research, right? Figuring out who our audience is. We always want to do that, but if we identify a market opportunity, that might be the next step. Whereas if we have, say, a strong prototype that came out of a game jam or on someone's lab day, then maybe what next is polishing that prototype and making sure it's, you know, really fun and that's there. Or if it's a contract opportunity, we still occasionally do contract work. Someone, you know, comes and says like, hey, we like your game. You know, Facebook comes and says, hey, we like your game Cluster Duck on the App Store. We want you to do a multiplayer version for Facebook. Well, then it's addressing that opportunity. All right, what's our pitch for the multiplayer? Or someone might be like, hey, we have this big IP and we want you to make a game of this IP. Well, then it would be a pitch document, you know, to that company going, you know, how are we going to do that? It also might be looking at the team, right? If we have all those things, we don't have a team, you know, I think that's something we're trying to get better at about going, what's next is go, okay, who's going to be on this and how do they work together? I think that's something that's been really hard for us because we constantly have projects going. And in the past, we kind of went, who's available? That's the team. And now we've been going, no, we should go, who works well together and has the skills and collectively, holistically, cohesively as a team, do they work together and have everything? Which is something, again, we're trying to get a little bit better at.
I just want to propose that I get 10 points every time Rick says cohesively.
Okay. Yeah, I will credit Sarah Dixie, our art director, on that.
Steven, you're keeping track?
Yeah.
And we make fun of each other for that. She says, like, cohesive once a meeting, and I say holistic, like, twice a meeting. And
you just own it. Just, it's like, that's the thing.
For sure.
No apologies, for sure.
At least you're not saying synergy.
Yeah.
So we can investigate those different avenues if you want. You know, how do we do market research, prototypes, pitches, or we can move on to your other questions. But those are the kind of, you know, potential different things that have to happen.
Well, I just wanted to emphasize one thing that I really like that y'all are, well, particularly working on, making sure that not just have the people who could do the thing, but also make sure that this is the team that's doing the thing.
Yeah.
Because we're kind of, we're struggling with that a little bit now because we're working on a new project. And the Future Club, most of our team works on Skullgirls, but we would like more people to work on this new project now.
Yeah.
And so, like, we're kind of having to balance our time with these two different projects. And we're kind of, I think we're kind of making assumptions on who can do a thing and who should do a thing.
Right. You're thinking in terms of capacity and, and little else. Right?
Yeah.
Because it's harder to think of it in any other way.
Right. Yeah. And so, like, as a result, what can happen is, like, you'll just get a bunch of people, you'll make plans for all of these things you want to do, but you won't have explicitly, you'll have told these people that you want to do these things and they'll maybe be on board with it right away, but they won't necessarily recognize immediately that, like, they've signed up to do two projects at the same time, you know? So, like, then they'll end up feeling overworked, and then both projects suffer as a result. So I guess I wanted to emphasize that because I think that's really important. It's just like starting out knowing who's on the team and what you can do.
Yeah.
I think is really cool.
We're still learning that. Don't get me wrong. We've only kind of just identified that. You know, we really in the last just year or two converted our executive producers into coaches. So they're more there, more like kind of have coaching certification or just there to help teams work together. It was really just our latest project where we actually went, well, we might not just use who's available. We need to make sure these people get along. Because we do often find, like you said, like, oh, this is a really strong programmer, but not in this engine or this type of games. Or he's a great game designer, but not in pre-production. Or these two are individually great, but have such different working styles that they don't gel.
Yeah.
We don't always have the luxury to just pull who we want, because then it's going to, if we're taking a strong person off of one project to build a new team around them, well, then that other project is going to suffer. So we haven't figured it out, but we're trying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and to be clear, our team is a team of less than 20 and you have a team of 200 people.
Yeah.
I guess it's a little bit different, but the problem is still the same.
Yes.
The same.
It definitely scales. Like our team of three is like immutable. Like we're not changing that.
right.
But we have to, but we keep holes in our thinking to like, we're going to fill it with stuff.
Yeah.
But what we fill it with is like, okay, well that's going to change our relationship to each other in terms of how we need to work together.
Right.
Sure.
And what it's a similar kind of thing, a similar kind of challenge.
Yeah.
On that same dimension. It's just, it comes at it from the other end, from the, we have to cut more things than we have to, like, in terms of like finding the right fit. Because we only have one configuration available to us. But you still are solving the same equation, right?
Right.
Yeah, I'm curious, Rick, in my world, we have such a range of sizes. We've got 3, 20, 200, 600. but the bulk of the 600 people who work for the company that I'm part of are working on courseware. They're not working on games. Mm-hmm. And that is starting to evolve as the different divisions that were recently acquired by the company I work for, ELB, have started to merge into one unit, right? Because that's now happening. Like, we're all getting the same email address, you know, which is a pain. But so one of the things that happens in game-based learning, because of its like close genealogy and close lineage with instructional design, is everything's very deadline-driven.
Oh, yeah.
And that's going to be the case, I think, in games as well. But, you know, like, we got an RFP 3 weeks ago for a project that needs to be done. There needs to be a pilot ready to test in November. That's nuts, right? And that timeline impacts really how we think about how we staff something.
Yeah,
because of a timeline that quick, you're just going to grab who's available.
Right.
And if you are the one person who can do something and you're not really available, well, you need to kick something that's low priority off your list, or you just crunch for it, which I'm trying to learn to say no to.
Yeah.
And that happens when we do it, or when we get contract work. If we do have something that's like, hey, you know, Facebook is going to give us money to port it over and we have 3 months, 6 months, it is kind of like, okay, who's available? And, you know, it's a finite thing. So maybe it's less okay. I mean, more okay to do it that way, less of a problem. But if we have a game that, you know, might take 2 years of development and then we're going to continue to build, well, that needs a strong vision from the start, and that needs a strong team.
And you want to carry that through as much as possible, because we've talked about this on the show before when we talked about Agile. Whenever you're reconfiguring a team, you're kind of going through that forming, storming, norming, performing every time you change it. So, swapping people in and out, it's not like changing Legos.
Yep. Another thing we're still learning and dealing with, because sometimes you have to do it because you need people, or, you know, someone's just unhappy and you want to support them and move them. But yeah, it's not like it just keeps going. You're right. You get a drop of productivity. And
well, I was going to say, since it depends so much, maybe we can pick two of those answers to it depends and kind of explore them in parallel. So like, what does it look like when you have, when you're starting to work on a game that started as a prototype or something that came from a game jam, and then flip the coin completely over and talk about the same kind of processes, that the same task that you need to undertake, but when the conditions are someone's contracted you for 3 months to do a port or something like that.
Sure.
Yeah.
So let's say we actually have a recent game, and I have to be careful because it's not out yet. We're going to soft launch it in a couple of months. So I forgive me if I talk around it or don't have specifics, but it came from a game jam prototype. It came from a lab day. One of our senior programmers, tech managers, who has sadly left us, but he's been with us for like 15 years. He was working on this on once a month. We have a lab day where you can just work on free stuff and upskill, which is great. And he built this little fun prototype, and it was a little kind of adventure dungeon delve game. And it was fun. There was a unique core mechanic twist to the combat that we thought was fun, and it had a little bit of replayability, and we thought it had potential. And so that was our step. We went, hey, this is fun, and it's kind of complete, you know. It's like the core loop is there and the underlying tech is there, and he's built some extensible. So hey, we're not sure if it has an audience, but let's prove out this prototype first. So what we did is we took a game jam. Actually, let me take a step back. We have two different jams at PicPoc. We have a game jam once a year, and the purpose of that is fun and team building. The purpose of that is to work with people you don't normally work with, try roles you don't normally try, and have a good time. Secondarily, if something good comes out of it, great. That's where Cluster Duck came from on the App Store. Our second jam is what we call the PIP jam, the PicPoc IP jam. And that's where we take an idea that has something, but it needs expansion. So it might be like, hey, we think there might be a market in, India and UK and New Zealand for a cricket game. Your job is to just do market research and see if there's a market for a cricket game. Or, we have this core gameplay, say, you know, driving gameplay for Agent Intercept. Come up with a new IP for that. Same core driving mechanics, but different world, different audience, different story, different tone. You know, something like that.
I'm like leaning in. I'm like, is that a thing? Let it be a thing. Is it a thing?
That's, Though we have another one I wish I could talk about too that came from it, where we had a core gameplay and I was part of a team that developed a new IP for it. And we're just, everybody at the company is so excited about this new IP and it's been developed so long, but we just don't have the resources, the business case quite yet to greenlight it. But it's been an IP we've been really, really excited about and has been driving people, and we've done repeated jams. And then another one might be like, hey, yeah, we need a prototype. Like we have this prototype, take it farther, or we have a design doc, turn it into a prototype. So that's what we did. We used an IP jam to go, hey, let's take Pete's prototype and make it a little better. And so they spent a week on it, and they did a mix of some research and working, and they, you know, added some art in. They kind of used existing art assets, but to put actual like characters and monsters in, it looked pretty good. And they toned the combat, and they did some design docs about how we could, you know, add those free-to-play elements and those progressions and the long-term kind of gameplay of, you know, growing and leveling up and making it stay interesting. And we were like, hey, there's something here. We do think this is good. Indeed, this game is fun now, and we could see how it could still be fun, and we could see how we could layer on social features and progression features. And so that was kind of it, where we went, hey, yeah, we do think there is a good game here. So if that doesn't happen, right, then it goes back in the bin. No, I shouldn't say the bin. That's a garbage in New Zealand. It goes back in the filing cabinet, the closet, whatever. Yeah. And waits for another opportunity, right? It may come around again, and we might take a second chance at prototyping it, or we might go do research again. But this one worked, and so we said, cool. Now the next step is market research. We think this game is fun. It's not enough. Is there an audience for this game? Right. And this is also where my role came in really interesting ways. So that's what we did. We went and go, is there research for a game like this? And we looked at the kind of people who played this genre of game. So kind of light casual, hybrid casual, we call it, role-playing games, you know, light role-playing elements. And we looked at people who played the kind of core mechanic, because we took a core mechanic from like kind of one genre and put it into this other genre. And we're like, oh, what do people play that? We did all that research. We're lucky at PicPoc, even though we're, you know, medium sized, we have a market research team and a games user research team and a good analytics team. So we actually have more data than most people do, especially at the smaller scale, which has been great learning for me, right? Like going from an indie artist where it's like, we got this creative vision to like, you know, learning how to figure out the data. And so our market research essentially said, this is great, but the game you have, this kind of hardcore, you know, old school D&D hack and slash fantasy, skews very male, older male. And the people who play hybrid casual RPGs and this kind of core mechanic you had skew much more broad age range and about even gender split, slightly leaning towards women. So we need a new theme. We need to market it differently. And so I had a really interesting task in that narrative design side of narrative designer to go, okay, we've looked at that. And this is where me and the art director came in and go, hey, we know this isn't going to be a story heavy game. It's about the mechanics. And, you know, it might be a little bit art heavy. So it doesn't need a plot, but man, it needs a theme. It needs a world. It needs an identity to appeal to this audience. So that's where I had this interesting task where I was like, all right, we've got this audience that we've identified. We've got these list of mechanics and systems. What is a theme, you know, I can come up with that makes all those systems and mechanics and actions make sense intuitively in that theme while also appealing to this new audience? And so it was a really fun exercise for me to go all these, you know, what about this? What about this? You know, what if instead they were pirates? What instead they were princesses? What instead they were, you know, treasure hunters? And what does that mean? How would this mechanic translate? And how would this mechanic translate? And, you know, how might we do the art style? And then, and then again, going, okay, what about the different characters? What if we do, you know, can we take old school fantasy, but just make it more casual based on the art style? Or actually, do we want to move away and do different types of fantasy or get out of fantasy altogether? And so it's this really interesting creative exercise driven by narrative and art and market research, art direction, concept art and art direction, but serving data and game mechanics and systems, right? It wasn't our job to tell a big story. It was our job to go, here's a world where all this shit makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so interesting to you constructed the box around which your problem solving needed to work in, right?
Yes.
And that's so appealing to me because it's so, if you are a very creative person, it can be so debilitating to be without those restrictions.
Yeah.
And the more you have, the more confident you can be in the choices you make. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's, especially with regard to the market research angle of it, which is sort of it's an existential requirement in this genre, but it feels a little bit like wagging the dog, right? That there are certain things you can't do, and they're not just restrictions; they're crossed off the list.
Yeah.
Right. And does that, like, how often do you butt against that? Like, hey, maybe we can forge a new path. I mean, you know, I mean, that's kind of a little bit of a movie plot kind of version of this, but you know what I'm saying, right?
I do.
It can be a little bit frustrating, perhaps, to be say, well, I guess we just have to do what this demographic already likes.
Yeah.
Right.
I really appreciate you bringing that up, Mark, because that's actually been one of our biggest learnings of late. We had a couple of projects that spun their wheels in pre-production because there weren't enough goals and restrictions and constraints. And when the sky is the limit, yeah, it's impossible, like you said. So one of our biggest learnings over the last couple of years is actually constraints are good, assuming you have a good why behind those constraints and assuming you identify the space that you can still play in. And so this was something that was successful about this project is we went, look, you have to go for this audience. And you can't change this prototype too hard. That core mechanic still has to be there. We're not changing that. And here's a basic deadline. It's not super sharp, but it needs to be vaguely in this time frame. Those aren't going to change. Mm-hmm. No prototype change, no audience change, no deadline change within reason. But hey, we have totally up to you what the theme and the art style is, you know, totally up to you what the long-term gameplay is and what mechanics you build around this and what systems you build around it. Have fun with that. Explore it, you know, go for it. And so the team did end up adding really interesting systems on top of those core mechanics that were really fun and really engaging for that audience. We ended up coming up with what we think is a really cool, you know, art style and world around it. And so the restrictions and constraints are one of the reasons, possibly the main reason, that this has been a more successful pre-production. That, and I do think we built a little bit better of a team around it. You know, our lead designer and our lead artist really worked well together, and we put some more senior people on it. Like, again, it's not always the art director and the narrative director getting involved, but we're like, all right, well, we can do this fast, and so we're going to help. So that was one of the reasons for success was those constraints. And we do still occasionally run into that with especially our game designers, and understandably, right, where they're like, this isn't fun for me. I want to do it. And again, that's a balance. There's no right or wrong there, right? Like sometimes the game designers have a point and they're like, okay, yes, I know we need to build out these monetizations and progression systems, but if a game isn't fun, it doesn't matter. And that's clear. But sometimes the artistic side, you know, can be too much. And they're like, but I want to explore. And we're like, there's no need to. Like, you're exploring in the wrong area. We have good data showing that people want this and they like this, and we're successful to make that. There's not a good argument to be made to change that. And so you're not helping. But again, you need to define the whys. Like, hey, here's the data showing people like it. Hey, here's the tools we have that we think are successful. But then also say, but here is the area you can play. You can't play there, but you can play over here. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also really important to define that and get people excited about that and go, look at the things you can do. Be excited about that. We want you to experiment there. We want you to go nuts there. We want you to have fun there. Just over there.
Yeah. Yeah. The earlier you can, like, there's this narrow passageway. Like, get on your tiptoes and good luck. Like, so that can be really exciting, right? Like, rather than feel like a big bummer, the earlier you define that, I think, the better, I imagine.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Yeah. And it's not always as narrow as people think. That's the thing. Right, sometimes it's just like, look, there's a room, and half the room you can't change, but the other half you totally can change. So look at the half you can change.
Yeah, I mean, you think of, like, I think about this sometimes when I'm, like, analyzing the need for where the game should focus, right? And, like, reality is fractal. You can go bigger, and it's interesting, and you can go smaller, and it's interesting, and you can look at, like, the cosmic level of things, and that's fascinating if you tell the right story, and you can look at the microscopic level of things, and that's fascinating if you tell the right story. So what I really like what you said, Rick, about, like, hey, you exploring is good. You've just been exploring in the wrong area.
Yeah,
to me, he's like, oh, okay, well, that's how we know Rick is a good manager, because he's framing a problem for his team in a way that can, you know, you can get excited about it. Because if you're only thinking about one half of the room, and that's the half of the room that you can't change, that is really demotivating.
Yeah.
But if someone can just say, zoom out a little bit, change where you're looking, and then look over here, then you see opportunity. And that can be energizing.
Also, that fractal, I think, is such a great way to frame it. Because it really, if you believe that, and I think I do, that means that no space is too small to play in.
Yeah. Right?
No matter how much your constraints are, whether you put them there or outside forces put them there, there's always space for your creativity and for doing new things.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I totally believe in that. Yeah. Tweak the number half an inch.
spreadsheets are fun.
That is exciting for people. Yeah. Like, our live ops people are like, holy shit, guys, you won't believe this. We tweaked this one number, one decimal place. And our sales rose 150%. Yeah. That's something to get excited about.
And some of my favorite games are like four colors, right? Like, or just like squares. It's that kind of thing, that kind of thinking. But what is, you know, what takes that kind of thinking and builds a team around it is being able to frame the challenges at the certain point.
Clearly stated. Yeah. And understand it and get people excited. I think that's why Andy hired me, because, you know, I feel so good. I've been here 4 years and I'm, you know, design manager and narrative director and speaking around the country at conferences. But I started as a mid-level game designer because I didn't know free-to-play games and I didn't have experience looking at data. But thankfully, you know, my boss and dear friend, Andy Satterthwaite, who's a lot of games industry experience, he's a Brit, but he says he's, you know, dour, but he's not. He's super excited. And he's like, we need someone enthusiastic like you. We need someone who can get people excited, get people happy. We need that at this company. So it's like, I'm going to take you in as a game designer, but I think you're going to go far. And so I really appreciate that. Because, I learned the ropes for 6 to 9 months as a game designer. And then we had the opportunity for managers. And then I was a natural fit for that, which was nice. So I kind of like leapfrogged the senior position and into manager. But I had previous leadership experience. But I needed to learn the ropes and learn that. But I also, we needed someone who could excite people and clearly communicate opportunities.
Yeah.
I normally start these things, don't I?
It's your turn.
It's always my turn. We're doing Patreon.
Nicegames.club/feedback.
No, that's the other one.
Okay, yeah, that's the other one. Right. Nice game. No, patreon.com/nicegamesclub. You can donate to us because the show costs money. It's not cheap. It's not super expensive. It's not cheap. Well, I don't know. I don't know all the costs.
I'll say our expenses exceeds our income.
Yes. Yes. Actually, that's a very good point.
Yeah.
If you can give us some money, that will help us bring you the content that you like. Like these episodes, this episode here. We got interviews. Thanks to Max. He's helping us book interviews, and that's really great. We have that due to the Patreon money that we're getting.
And Max is, frankly, cheaper than he should be.
Yes.
And already costs us more than we'd like. So,
yes.
This is my, panhandler version of the pitch.
Mm-hmm.
Like, please, anything you can spare.
Yeah.
But there's something in it for you as well.
Right. You also get ad-free episodes. There's a bunch of exclusive Patreon content. I've listed those many times, but if you like pictures of dogs, Ellen's dogs are on there.
Yeah. I should add some more. I've got so many good ones, you guys.
Yeah, so you get benefits out of it too. It's a mutually beneficial arrangement. So if you join us at patreon.com/nicegames, we'd appreciate it.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Well, let's come at it from the other end now.
Yeah.
So we've been talking about you've got a prototype, and then you have to sort of make it work in the systems you have, define new systems, bring in that market research. But one of the examples you gave in your list earlier was identifying a market before you have anything going on.
Yeah.
So how do you get from there, which can be a lot sort of a colder calculation, to the finding the fun of a prototype? Because it's a different set of inputs that might not be as familiar to a game designer who might be more comfortable starting with a game jam, right?
Yeah.
But in the end, you need to have something that's just as fun as when you started from the fun, right?
Yeah. And that is a big challenge because you have to put on that market research hat. And to a certain extent, as game designers, we always have our audience hat on. But it's more that moment to moment. Like, I, as a player, what do I want? I think there's similarity and a difference between thinking like a player, as in one person in the moment, what decisions do I want to make, and an audience, like, what do we as a broad demographic want to see? And that's the kind of view you have to have. So I'll give you, again, there's things I can't speak about, but I can give you a broad example. We make Rival Stars Horse Racing, but we also in the past did Rival Stars Basketball and Rival Stars College Football. And we went, hey, are there room for more Rival Stars sports games? And so a lot of the times that's where we go. We go, hey, we think there might be a market for cricket or gymnastics or whatever. And so a lot of that will be like, yes, we think there's a market. Here's the people. Our market is fans of this sport. Here's some more data that we think of people who are fans of this sport. can you make a game out of it? And then that can be a real challenge because your step, it's usually not a prototype. That usually starts with a design document, mm-hmm. right? Like, here's a design document of what the core loops and systems are. Here's a little more market research, and maybe here's some creative and artistic stuff. And that can be really freeing or really challenging, because if you get too hung up on where, like, you know, I don't like cricket, so I don't care about this, then, you know, it can be really hard to find the fun in it. Or again, it could be almost too much of a green space where you're like, well, keep mentioning cricket because it's a New Zealand specific thing. Again, we looked at it, decided not to do it. But, you know, but it could also be too much where it's like, what does a cricket game mean? Is it a moment to moment game where you're bowling and batting? Mm-hmm. Is it a management game? Is it more about the players where you're collecting your team and leveling up the players? Is it more of a coach game where you're, you know, or like a football manager where you're also managing the stadium and stuff? Like, there's so many different things a cricket game could be. And again, if depending on your brief, that could be really freeing or really, really yeah. difficult. So it definitely helps to, again, have those constraints, or just pick an angle. And if you don't know, just go look. Theoretical game designer, you know, and I focus on mechanics. That's my thing. I want fun moment to moment mechanics. So since I've been given this market, that's what I'm going to pitch. I'm going to design a game that is really fun moment to moment mechanics, and hopefully it'll fit that audience. And yeah, if it's a free to play game, we need to layer on those progression systems too, but I'm going to start with what I'm good at. Or, hey, if I'm a narrative designer leading this, then I'm going to focus on the feels and the IP and, you know, the player stories and the drama. And maybe or maybe not, that's right. But I'm at least starting from something I know and I'm excited about and hitting
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
And it may or may not work, right? You might do that and go, cool, that's a really strong pitch. And it does technically go to this audience. But now once we investigate it more, actually, we find that no, cricket people don't want player drama. They're actually all about the skill in the sport and that. And then it's like, all right, cool. Then you pivot, you know, try a new thing.
Yeah, you just need a place to start.
Which is, I think, the biggest thing we should talk about is, yeah, you start right. somewhere. You try something. Yeah. And then if it's wrong, you try a different
yeah,
thing. Because
yeah.
you're never going to get it right on the
right,
first try,
right.
ever.
Yeah, I think iteration, I think, is the probably what we might want to spend the rest of the episode talking about. but what's fascinating about these two ways in is that it just as you describe them, you really quickly ended up in the same place with those two examples.
Yeah,
and you started out by saying that it really depends on where you start. There's lots of different ways. But I would venture that it doesn't take that long, at least in terms of like a mental leap anyway. I mean, in terms of how long it takes in terms of time and effort. It might be different for the different paths.
Sure.
But it does seem like ultimately you do end up at the same place where you are then now considering yep. all the inputs rather than the first one you started with.
You're exactly right.
And I guess it seems like
your
instinct is probably to get there as quick as possible to promote all the other interests to equal status with what got things going.
Yeah, because you're right. You're absolutely right. You always need, you know, an audience and a business case, a design doc and a prototype, and then, you know, the sort of resource stuff, your staff, your team, your deadlines. You're always gonna have that. And yeah, the sooner they come together, the better. And yeah, the biggest thing. So I'm actually, here's a potential segue for you. ENZA GDC, New Zealand Game Developers mm-hmm. Conference, not quite as big as the GDC where we met. Though I did submit a talk there just now, the deadline's just closed. So we'll see if I see you guys there. And so GDC, I'm giving a talk called The Art of the First Draft, because I think that's something we've been really bad at. And that's actually a phrase I've been using at PicPoc for the last year, is shitty first draft. And I use that phrase specifically mm-hmm. because a lot of times our creatives get hung up. They want it to be perfect. They're, you know, because, you know, even in a positive way, criticism can be really hard. And people's instinct are to poke holes in things. So they want to protect it. They don't want something with holes. You know, feedback is difficult. If you're creative, you don't want to show your stuff. You know it's going to be wrong. And so I've been trying to, and I think it's really catching on, especially in the design departments and associated narrative and UX and audio. That's why I say shitty specifically. Mm-hmm. I'm like, no, the first draft's job, its only job is to mm-hmm. exist. That's all it needs to do. So make it bad. I say faster and worse. That's my thing. I was like, no, make it faster and make it worse. I was like, stop solving that problem, because you're not going to solve it correctly. Because you're going to find out from research that the audience doesn't care about that. Or you're going to find out from the artist that we technically can't implement the art that way anyway. So stop trying to solve that problem. Just tell me what your intent is. Mm-hmm. And get it out there as fast and as bad as possible so people can start to identify what's good about it. Leave holes, you know, go and go, hey, I haven't figured this out yet. Mm-hmm. But I know you guys can figure it out better. And I think I figured out the things around it. So
I'm looking forward to that talk. That's something I think I need to hear, because I do tend to over design before I actually put pen to paper.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, a lot of times you just really just need to just do it really quickly. So you just have something, and then you can be like, oh, this is terrible. Why did I do it this way? But then you could realize that you made bad decisions, and you could change those decisions.
Yeah.
Instead of just being like, no, this decision is probably good, but let me think about it a little bit more for another 3 months. Like that just
right, exactly. Wouldn't you rather know it's bad in 3 hours than in 3 months?
Yes.
Everyone else would rather know. Yeah. Well, but here's a really interesting thing is I think that goes back to, you know, one of the earlier steps you were talking about, Rick, which is forming the team, right? Because being able to design with holes means that you trust your team to come in and help you patch those, fill them in, right? Yeah. And if you don't have people that you trust, then that can be really difficult to let go of those pieces or even just say, I just kind of scribbled this in with crayon because I know that you guys will be able to help me out. Mm-hmm. If you don't trust the people with you, you're going to be like, I scribbled this in with crayon, but don't be mad.
Yeah.
You know? So.
Yeah, you're totally right. Trust is a prerequisite. And that's, so two thoughts on that is one, I do see designers running into that. And one of the things in more detail I've had to coach people say, look, be clear. It's okay to say, I don't want feedback on that. Like if someone, and we see this all the time, right? We're like, here's an idea. And they're like, oh, I don't know if I like that character name. And I have to go, stop. I'm not looking for feedback on names. It is just there as a placeholder so I can pitch to you the things around it. So just don't give me feedback on that, you know? And sometimes it does require that or going, hey, up front, I need you guys to know that there are holes. I want you to fill them. Don't tell me there are holes. I know that they're there. So it does take some coaching to get people in that mindset. But in the broader way, it's one of the reasons that, like, you know, I have these two jobs of design manager supporting the game design team and setting, you know, strategies for our department and things like that, how we work with other departments, and narrative director keeping the narrative quality and setting those processes. But really, honestly, my job is helping people work together. My job is helping people build trust. It's mediating discussions. It's facilitating brainstorm sessions. It's, you know, resolving conflicts between people. It's coaching people on communication and listening and collaboration skills. Like, that's my job.
Oh, so you're also a scrum master. Cool. You have three jobs.
Essentially. Like,
Yeah.
When you're trying to instill that philosophy of the shitty first draft, I think there is two ways to do that. There's the, you say, make it smaller and worse, but there's also the get comfortable throwing things away.
Yeah.
Because I think, like,
because
I find myself very frequently working really, like, doing that perfection thing.
Yeah.
But what I've taught myself is, and maybe this was wrong, probably wrong in a larger team, but what I tend to do is, instead of trying to tame that tendency, because I find that it does, for me personally anyway, in certain scenarios, it does also stymie my creativity. And that's just a thing I've not learned to get around.
Sure.
That's not like a philosophy. I just haven't learned to do that.
Okay.
But what I have learned, to do is get comfortable throwing it away.
Yeah.
And so, and so I think that,
I
imagine that's a matter of like team cohesion, because you'll have people on the spectrum of that, right? Mm-hmm. So do you focus on getting people together who feel similarly, or do you focus on you setting, because like you say, you need to drill it into people. Everyone's got to find their way to a result anywhere. Like, what's the easier job, frankly? Is getting people to align or to kind of impose a shitty first draft? Because they both sound terrible to the person receiving that those instructions. But you got to do it one way or another, right?
Yep. And yeah, killing your darlings is a classic. You know, that's something you'll always hear as a writer, and it is good advice. The softer way, I mean, I think it's important, and we should say, you know, again, I use shitty for a reason. I think saying killing your darlings is a good one. But when I have to frame it more positively, I say bad ideas lead to good ideas. So don't be afraid of bad ideas, and don't be afraid of losing bad ideas, because they lead to a better idea. I think it's a little easier to impose the shitty first draft, because I can just say, like, look, I want something tomorrow, and I'm not going to judge you on it, and I don't care what it is, and you're not going to get in trouble, and, you know, I'm not going to, you know, whatever, but I want to see it tomorrow. So that's a little easier. Alignment is much, much harder, because the shitty first draft, usually you can point to one role. Like, it's harder to get a whole prototype shitty, but I can be like, hey, narrative designer, give me your crappy script tomorrow. Hey, game designer, actually, can you give me the half done version of your game design document at the end of this week? Cause that's a little more singular, you know, same thing with concept artists where they're like, just give me a drawing. Whereas alignment is the whole team, right? And that requires everybody talking again and understanding the constraints and understanding the audience and having those hard conversations and those trusts to be like, hey, I don't understand this constraint. And then having the leadership say, well, here's why it's there, and getting them on board, or having the people who have two different creative things get in a room and talk to each other and be like, where are we similar in our different creative ideas? And there's just no shortcut to that.
So do you find that doing that first thing makes the second thing easier, or is that second thing just never easier?
I do think, yes, having somewhere to start with does make it easier. And I think that's one of the reasons that I'm in the role I'm in, is I can do two things. Is one, I can get something 80% of the way there in like an hour. I am not as good at any of our game designers or narrative designers at the final product. Every single person who works for me is better than me, you know, at those jobs. They can come up with better mechanics and better systems and better word choices and better characters. But I can usually get it almost there in like a couple hours instead of a couple months. And so I think that helps. People go, oh, okay, I can kind of see the shape of that. Yeah, okay. So, and then they can go and get it and go, but you know, this part doesn't work and this part doesn't work. I'm like, yeah, you're right, they don't. But now that they see that those parts don't work, and they're like, oh, I can make that better. So that helps. The other thing I think I have my job is I can get people excited. I can say, holy shit, look at this thing. Isn't this amazing? Isn't this fun? Like, look at this space we get to play. Look at this opportunity. This is great. Go for that. And yeah, occasionally people are like, I can't because I have these restrictions. They'll be like, oh, you're right. But have you seen that you can do this? And, you know, it's not always easy, but I'm generally about good at getting people excited about what they can do. And so I think like showing them, creating that loose shape quickly and getting people excited about what that loose shape could be, I think are things that I'm good at. And taking it to that final level of polish, you know, they say that last 10% is the hardest. Those are things that I'm bad at. But thankfully, there are other people at the company that are very good at that. And I can let them do that and trust them to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I forgot the name of the Pareto principle. I had to look it up real quick. I'm like, 80-20. Yeah. That's a thing.
Right. 80% of the effort and the last 20% of the work.
But,
yeah.
Yeah. But a lot of the value comes from that initial like spike of thinking. And if you don't have that good foundation, then you've got nothing, you know. No one thinks of a foundation. There's probably some people out there. I was going to say, a few people look at a foundation and they're like, oh,
I do. I mean, I'm a structure guy in my writing. And
yeah, you're probably managers, producers.
Yeah.
Even as a creative guy, like structure is the way I approach writing. Like I want to make sure that all the plot points add up and all the pieces of the world, you know, fit together in interesting ways. And, you know, I like that. But exciting people isn't actually easy. Part of it is authenticity, right? I think that's something we all need to have. You have to be genuinely yourself when you interact with people, and you have to show your own. No one buys into fake enthusiasm. It has to be real. So you have to find the things you're enthusiastic about, even if you're not, because you have to be authentic. And that's hard. And again, getting people to understand is hard. You know, you can show them the area to play, but they still want to play in the other area. So that can be hard to bring them along. And then people might get excited about different things and then, you know, misalign it. Or, you know, a hard, hard lesson for me is that too much enthusiasm can really scare New Zealanders. Kiwis tend to be pretty low key. I can never not be myself, though I did have this, like, I am possibly the most confident person I know. Like, I am who I am, and I'm cool with that, and I love uplifting other people, and I think I'm awesome, but I think everybody else is awesome, and I want them to feel that. But I did kind of have a little bit of a learning curve where I'm like, oh, do I need to not be that in New Zealand because of the culture? And then eventually, you know, I got through that and was like, no, I need to be myself, but I can still strategically, like, turn those dials. I can be like, actually, now is not the time. This meeting is not the place when they need the enthusiasm. So it's okay for me to tone it down a little bit in this meeting. Or it's okay for me to use different word choices with this person who is, you know, very Kiwi and very low key and very the British, like, you know, everything is shit. There's that great Bill Bailey bit. Bill Bailey's a British comedian where he talks about, he's like, I love Australians and Americans because they're like, everything is awesome. Awesome. Everything's awesome. What'd you do yesterday? I kicked stones in the rain and it was awesome. But British, he's like, if you ask any Brit how they are, they will say not too bad. It's like, that's the best things to ever get. They're clearly bad. But they're not as bad as they could be. And that kind of like cultural attitude is something I've had to learn. And, you know, we have 30 odd countries represented at PicPoc. And so it's a constant balancing act to be like, okay, with certain Brits and Kiwis, I actually need to tone it down a little bit. With, you know, the Aussies, like I can be really excited and that's okay. You know, the Chinese and Bulgarians are going to be very direct. The Russians are going to be very negative, but that doesn't mean they want me to be negative. They're actually okay. That's just how they're going to like present. The Argentinians are going to be excited and swearing at me, but it's not mean swearing. It's just, you know, them getting excited. And like, I don't think people talk about that enough. Like, obviously I'm painting in broad strokes here, but there are clearly cultural working differences and you have to address them. And it makes it really hard to be a creative and a leader when, you know, it could be that you've actually answered all those questions about process and constraints and alignment and all that. And it's just like, hey, in the Chinese way in video games, it's much more directive, but the New Zealand way is much more, you know, ground up. And there's the problem is just prior work experience. And yeah, how do you get around that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to account for everybody's like intuition about how to interact with their coworkers. Yeah. And those, you know, because of different experiences, those intuitions are not always going
to
be the same.
Right. And those experiences aren't even necessarily just like due to different cultures from different
countries.
Yeah, for sure.
Just be, I don't know, like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. All three of us, you know, we've lived in Minnesota for a long time and we work differently too. Right. Yeah. And
so we have how you grew up, different companies.
Well, it's another dimension on the forming.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. It's another dimension of like from all of that, you need to build a company culture.
Yeah.
And it seems like at Pickpock you'd have one extra dimension in that challenge.
And,
right?
Yeah. I am glad that you brought up go ahead. What were you gonna say? Oh, okay. I am glad that you brought up getting people on board with the idea because like, you know, the higher up signed up on the game doesn't necessarily mean that everybody is excited about working on the game. And I think that like finding their way to being interested in the game is sometimes a challenge. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I'll speak for myself. I'm working on a horror game and I hate scary things, right? but like I found what I really appreciate about this game idea, and I'm really excited about this aspect.
Perfectly said. That's exactly the advice I would give. Like, you may not be on board with the core, but you can find that piece that does excite you.
Yeah, so I guess that's what I was going to ask about. And it.
No, you answered it, sir. You had the insight before you even...
Thank you. Well, there you go.
You
got to
find the piece. You may not be on board with the core, but maybe there is a sub part of it that you can get really excited about and make that as good as you can. Or maybe sometimes it's like, look, we need to tick the boxes, right? This sprint in our horse racing game, actually all we're doing is balancing the numbers of the events. It's all we're doing is rebalancing the difficulty. But actually, if I get that done, I might be able to do something else on top of that. You know, I rebalanced it. Now I have extra time. So I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
And also, I'm going to rewrite the story around the event. You know, and I didn't have to do that, but I can do that because you know, I tick the boxes I need to tick. And then I put in some extra effort to do the thing I was excited about.
Yeah.
That's like a resource-driven approach to scope. It's like you're not just saying we're only doing this. You're saying we only have time to do this.
Right. Yes.
And so, but let's be excited and do more.
Yeah, if we can find a way.
We keep to that original constraint,
Yeah, and not working overtime. I'm just saying sometimes you want to scope smartly, right? You don't actually want to put people at 100% capacity because you know that there's going to be problems and meetings and whatever. And or maybe they'll find that the problem wasn't as hard to solve as they thought. And, you know, or again, maybe they, because we know we're going to be repeatedly balancing it, they got the shitty first draft balancing out first, and then they can do other things, and we know we're going to rebalance it in the next week.
Well, that's key to iteration, right? Because you have to budget the particular thing you're doing, but you know, I mean, within reason, iteration can be an infinite process.
Absolutely.
So how do you handle that within a particular cycle of that? Thinking like, what's the judgment process of like, how close are we getting? What are the criteria we use? What does that like stem to stern iterative process go? When do you allow yourself to be like, well, it'll be done when it's done, even though that's the scariest phrase project management.
Yes, and we do have those different approaches, right? Sometimes we do say, yeah, just take the time until you find the fun. We're willing to invest in this, you know, this game because we believe in this IP and this team, so take it. And you know, and sometimes that bites us in the ass. We've definitely done that with projects and go, boy, you know, actually after a year we didn't manage to find the fun and we need to cancel this, so you know, lesson learned. Usually, though, you know, we do have product owners, POs, and they usually try and set metrics. You know, the way we don't always achieve this, but what we aspire to is the PO sets the what and the designers figure out the how, or the team really, I should say designers because I'm designed, but the whole team. So the PO says, look, our goal is to increase, you know, retention of players who have been playing 30 days or more. So people who have been in the game for 30 days want to lift them up. Or our goal is to get more people playing live events, or our goal is to boost sales, or, you know, they give some kind of data driven. Then they go, well, up to you guys how you do that. Maybe you can do it by rebalancing. Maybe it needs a new feature. You know, and sometimes we do say, you know, we've done the research and we think we need to add this new feature and design it. But whether it's saying like this KPI needs to move or we need to create this feature, you know, well, even if you're creating the feature, you're probably next to have the KPI. It's like, hey, we're going to add this new racing mode in the game. And we think that's there because, you know, we've done our market research and we've listened to the community and you know, we have the tools and the skill set. So we think that this will give us a lot of value. It'll give people a new way to play the game, a way for people to keep coming back, new horses, etc. But at some point, it's like, you know, you set those numbers. Here's what we're looking for. And yeah, you iterate essentially until you either see that KPI move or realize that you can't move it. And then, you know, you consider it a failure, but in the learning sense, right? Oh, hey, we tried to do that and we tried a bunch of things and none of them worked. So cool. All right. We don't know how to easily do that. We're going to try something else. Or again, you iterate until you see, okay, it moved. So, you know, either we can keep building on that success or now we can do something else. Or maybe we moved a little, but we think with another round, it can move more. So it does help to have those specific metrics and goals. Though that usually is more when you have a completed game and are adding new features versus when you're trying to do a prototype, because then it is much more nebulous where it's like, is it fun?
Right.
And you can do that, right? We do internal tests. We bring people to play, or we do user tests. Yeah. We do bring people outside to play it. And, you know, we present design docs and we have people with, you know, 10, 20, 30 years of industry experience who can say, yeah, based on my intuition and experience, and based on the feedback from the user tests, we think that this prototype is in a good place.
It sounds like, to me, a lot of limits. You still need limits. Just like find those limits. And I think, like even if it's just a time limit or a money limit, some form of resource limit will help you, just say like, okay, this is a good time to stop the iteration process.
Mm-hmm. We can
release something. We're confident on this now.
Well, I mean, I'm hearing a lot, like you say, like the product owner who decides the what.
Yeah.
It's not so much, let me know if I'm getting this right. It's not so much that there's like specific metrics, although it sounds like there probably is in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it's just somebody's judgment that needs to determine whether to move forward or whether to call it.
Yeah,
you know, right? And that every iterative process might be different in terms of what that judgment is based on, but it's up to someone, and that's almost more important than like defining the actual thing that it needs to hit.
Because even if you have that metric of, because we will have specific metrics like, hey, we want to increase sales by X percent in this area. But even then you still have to go, cool, well, we increased it by 9% instead of 10%. Is that good enough? Or we increased it by 12%, but we think with another week, can we get 20? Do we want to involve that week? Or, you know, so you're right. At some point there is that judgment. And that's hard. That's hard for so many reasons. One, because making decisions is hard. Making decisions is always hard. Even if you have data, it's so hard to interpret the data and go, what does this actually mean? Correlation, causation, et cetera. So hard to make decisions in general as a human. It's hard to actually interpret data, even if you have a lot of it. And it's hard to do it in a collaborative culture. I think that's the good and the bad of New Zealand and PicPoc, because I think we have a very collaborative culture and teams do listen to each other and they speak up and they share. And sometimes that can be really great and we get the best ideas because everybody has a chance. And sometimes it can be really bad because you might get like, you know, a junior game designer who's like, has 6 months of experience and is like, I don't think this is the right direction. And we got to go, well, that's not your call to make. I'm sorry. Like, we want to hear from you. We'll listen to your feedback. But no, you actually don't get to make that decision.
Right. There needs to be a decision maker. And so to kind of circle back between this, the product owner that I work with on a regular basis, because I do a split of projects and product, and it's the product owner's job to set the sprint goals, like you were saying, Rick.
Yep.
You know, like, okay, this sprint, our goal is to do this.
Yep.
And what she's doing when she sets that goal is she's reflecting all the conversations she's been having with high-level stakeholders in the company and the CEO and the customers and the players of the customers and so on and so forth. And so we don't see all that because we don't need to be in those meetings. We can't be in those meetings because we're working on the product.
You're totally right.
And so that's where that decision-making comes from.
Yeah, you're right. A good product owner doesn't just come down and be like, here's the law, right? They should have looked at all the data, talked to all the key stakeholders from above and on the team and go, right, based on my discussions with all of you and my looking at the data and my talking to the, you know, leaders of the company, this is what I think we should do.
Yep.
Right. It's not their job to be the better expert than everyone else, right? It's their job to make the decision, and they can only do that with like data gathering, discussions, and trust, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Collating. And sometimes it's just the way it's presented. Like, I know we occasionally have product owners who do that, but they're not good at communicating that they've done that. So people are like, they just tell me what to do. But, you know, sometimes they need to listen more. Sometimes they just need to communicate better and just say, hey, I have listened to you and I have heard you and because of these reasons. So a lot of the time, like a right decision communicated in the wrong way can feel like a wrong decision.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Who gets points for that phrase?
I'm sure I didn't make it up. I'm sure I've heard it somewhere. But
50 points to Steven, I guess.
Yeah, I'm winning.
Well, it was cohesive, right?
Yeah.
How many do you need to beat Steven?
I need three more cohesives.
How many more cohesives?
Yeah, I didn't say it as much as I could.
It only counts if Rick says it.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. I've been failing. My holistic approach has not been paying off in a cohesive podcast.
I get points for that one, right?
Yeah, you get. I think you get points for holistic.
All right, thank you.
There
you
go. I got 50 points. I'm
yeah, you're doing well. I didn't expect so much of this. I mean, in hindsight, it doesn't surprise me, but like, I didn't expect so much of our discussion today to end up in like the sphere of Agile, which comes up on this podcast a lot because I have a Scrum Master certification, which has lapsed, but it's there somewhere there in the background.
Yeah.
My husband was a Scrum Master professionally for a while. And so it comes up a lot, you know, in these conversations. And also, you know, whenever I'm talking about work at home, it's always gets turned back around on me in Scrum terms.
No.
No, it's probably fine. So yeah, I guess, but the thing is we, you know, we framed today's discussion as how do you decide what to do next? And that's really a lot of what Agile is about is how do you decide what to do next?
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
So that totally makes sense.
Well,
and,
I think,
you know,
I mean,
we're still learning it. Just to quickly say, like, Agile is great and we use it, but we don't use it by the book. You know, we adapt and every team is a little bit different. And also sometimes Agile doesn't perfectly work for video games because Agile is built around much more technical stuff and it doesn't quite account for the creative side. And we sometimes run into problems where we're like, there's not really a good, you have like spikes, but there's not really a good way to just go, we just need to make an engaging IP in a fun game. And so, you know, it breaks down on occasion. Sorry, Mark, you had something.
Well, my understanding is that Agile is not something anybody does to the letter.
Yeah.
Right?
It's like, it's the start of the journey rather than the end.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if there might be Scrum Masters out there, you know, but I think we've sort of, Ellen, you're right. We circled these types of topics a lot. And I think that could be something we could put on a t-shirt, which is like, praise be to the bureaucrats.
Right? Like, explain.
Wow.
Well, I mean, because like you need systems, you need workflows, and only through that can you be maximally both productive and creative and artistic.
Yeah.
And whatever you're, you know, whether you're doing, you know, free to play games in a studio with lots of people and lots of data and analytics driving a lot of your decisions, or you're making like a little itch game that you kind of know in your heart no one's going to see. Like that doesn't change the need for systems and workflows. It certainly changes the expression of those things.
Right.
Yeah.
But like that, those philosophies and those sort of like the way you set your priorities and the way you sort of evaluate your own doings is something that everyone, no matter what they're making or what environment they're in.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, you need to.
I'm doing a real summary job here. I hope that's all right.
Well, it's absolutely critical and you need it and you're right. But it also goes back to other points you guys were making. I think Ellen said but you need the trust, right? If all you do is processes, but you don't account for people, the different cultures, the time taken to build that trust, the way of, you know, ameliorating those different working styles, like then it might break down. That's my other NZGDC talk this year, by the way, is it's based on a text I got from one of my students where they were complaining about collaborating with difficult people. And I told them all you need to do is people more and people weirder and eventually you'll people better. And I'm like, that would make a good talk. And so I submitted it. And
nice.
And that's what it is. It's about going like, we need all these processes. They are very important. But you can't forget to actually connect with actual humans and build that team culture and build trust.
Right. It's not a manual to follow. Yeah. It's a way to get to the peopling.
Yeah. And I've got a what I think is a good story. You guys can edit it if it's not. that's a great thing about a podcast that I use a lot at work about Agile to get to what you were saying, Mark, which is, so I'm out of practice because I moved to New Zealand and life changed, but I'm a Wing Chun Kung Fu instructor. I'm a multi-level black belt and ran a bunch of classes in Texas. And I had the privilege, so my Sifu, which is a Chinese equivalent of sensei, actually it's not equivalent, it means Kung Fu father. My Sifu was the top guy in the States and he trained directly under the Grandmaster in Hong Kong, Lung Ting, who trained directly under Ip Man, who you might know from all the movies about him.
Oh, wow.
So,
that's so cool. Sorry. Yeah. I really like Ip Man.
Okay, I have to interrupt the show. I saw the first one of those movies at a film festival.
Yeah.
And then years later, I'm like checking in. I'm like, what has this franchise become?
It's kind of weird that it just exploded. I mean, Donnie Yen is great. So, Ip Man taught my grandmaster, who taught my master, who taught me. Which is really neat, because most people it's, you know, 7 or 8 or 10 different, you know, lineages there. So yeah. Once a year, yeah, I would get to train with the Grandmaster directly. He'd come to our school, and he was, wow, doing this footwork, and I just couldn't do it, you know. And this was, I think I was a first or second black belt, so I was pretty good, but still growing. And I just had to pull him aside, and I was like, Sigong, I can't do this. I'm like, I'm watching you do it, and I just can't. And he goes, of course not. He goes, don't be a slave to the kung fu. I was like, what? He's like, look at you. He's like, you're a foot taller than me. And like, you know, you're 25 years younger than me. And he's like, of course you can't do it. Like, I move differently than you. This is the philosophy, but you have to, you know, adapt for your own needs. Don't be a slave to the kung fu. And so when people get caught up in those agile processes, I'll often tell them that story and be like, don't be a slave to the kung fu. Like, it's there as, yeah, a model and a template, but you got to figure out how you fit into it.
Yeah.
And if like the best martial artist in the world, you know, he is like the top guy in the most popular martial arts in the world. If he says that, it's got to be good advice, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, again, we've come to the conclusion that all things are all things.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is
that's my, I love it when we get there in an episode. It's my favorite place to be.
Yeah. Kung Fu is agile as game development is. Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I think we made that triangle connect. Yep.
Well, we squared that circle. That's a business term. They say that sometimes.
No, negative 50 points.
Oh! Well, it's a good thing the points don't matter.
True. He says now.
You're the last person I would expect to say that sentence.
Yeah. But I'm losing.
In the, yeah, fair, in the situation, fair, where he's down, I would kind of expect. Yeah,
like, I want to see the leaderboard at the end.
Okay, so Rick, if people wanted more wisdom from you, where can they find you on the internet?
Oh yeah, I'm probably less active than I could be. I'm a, what's the term? I'm an in-betweener. I was born in the early 80s, so I grew up without the internet, but I'm comfortable with it. And, you know, I'm the, mm-hmm, kind of guy who has lifelong friends. The first friend who visited me in New Zealand was a gamer friend I met online when I was in college. And we were virtual friends for, you know, a decade before we met and became good friends. So I'm comfortable with that. But I also, nice, like, don't deal with like Twitch streamers and stuff. And I'm like, I don't get these VTubers. So I can like equally be like connected and cranky old man. So yeah, I don't think I have a great social media presence, but you can, but I try and get actively involved in the community. So if you're in New Zealand, you probably have met me. I've spoken at like a dozen universities, every game dev meetup, every conference in film and video games, you know. I try and get out there every mentorship thing. So you can find me on Facebook, for sure, Rick Stem. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm on Instagram, but I mostly just post pictures of New Zealand scenery.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, right. Because it's,
I mean, that's your best bet to get anyone to go to something.
Yeah. and I do speak at conferences. So that's one of the best. So yeah, like I've spoken at PAX, at NZGDC, at GDC, at other things. So finding me at games conferences is great. But I'm also on Discord too. I'm in a couple of different like narrative servers on Discord, but I like to talk to people. So like if you friend me on Facebook or LinkedIn, or if you email me, which is really easy, rick@pickpock.com. It's my name at the company I work for, Rick at Pickpock. I'll respond. I can't promise to respond in any given time frame or to give you any specific amount of time, but I do promise to respond. And I do a lot of just chats with people where someone's like, how do I get into the games industry? And I'll be like, well, we'll talk about it. Or what is it like to be a narrative designer? We'll talk about that. I actually just had a meeting with someone from the TV industry about that yesterday, and someone from marketing who wants to get narrative design later today. So I'm always happy, cool, to just sit down and chat with people. And I've got an IGDA mentor talk tomorrow. So like the best thing to do is just contact me directly, you know, like a person, like send me a message or an email or a post and be like, let's get on a video call and talk.
Yeah.
That's great. It's, yeah, it's really great that you're that open. I that's very appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's tough to be that open.
Yes.
Be that available. So it's cool that you do that.
It's
the only way I can connect. Like my social media presence, yeah, sucks. I would not get a job as an influencer, despite being so charming. But I like to connect.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics and some of the things that Rick's involved in, go to our website, nicegames.club, and we will put those links up there for you where you can click on them and go to those places. Cool. We are on social media, thanks to Dale, because she posts about game dev resources and unsung heroes of game dev, and that's at Nice Games Club. You can find us on various platforms or email us, contact@nicegames.club. We are also on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub, and if you want to keep things more casual, stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be looking at grind and emphasizing uniqueness. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
I mean, I asked the question.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Oh, wait. Sorry. I thought you were redoing the intro because you were talking about it.
No. We're just goofing about it being one take.
We don't
do two takes.
No. We just cut things out. Right. Or we leave it in.
No, I do. Right, I do enjoy that a guest is. We're so jovial on air that we're fooled a guest into thinking we're off mic. I enjoyed that very much.
That's good.
Thank you for that validation.
Right. That speaks to the quality and genuine authenticity of your podcast.
You use
that voice tip for free.
Yeah, it's nice.
Put that on a book jacket.
That's right.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.